Thursday, December 6th, 2012. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight we present a discussion on the Masonic scholar and author, Albert Pike, his legacy and his unique contributions to American Masonry and the Western esoteric tradition. Pike was and still is a very controversial figure. He was a paradox. He was opposed to slavery, and yet he served as a general in the Confederate Army. He was an advocate of Native American rights and led a regiment of Confederate Indians against the Yankees, whom they hated. And he was the father of Scottish Rite Masonry in America, rewriting and organizing a jumble of Continental Masonic degrees into a coherent system that has become the largest Masonic jurisdiction in the world. He was an occultist, much influenced by Eliphas Levy, and a proponent of the Hermetic tradition, which he showcased in his favorite Scottish Rite degree, Knight of the Sun, formerly the 28th degree, which he devoted more text to any other degree in his classic Morals and Dogma of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite. 200 pages to it, by the way. Even back in the 19th century, he was a lightning rod for anti-Masons, being the alleged Luciferian master of the mysterious lady sex magician Diana Vaughan in the great French Palladian hoax. So, if you want to get the inside story on this giant of American Masonry and his efforts to preserve the ancient mysteries behind Freemasonry, tune in and we'll shed some light on the subject. That's Light with a capital L. Also, too, we did a show on the Palladians. You can look it up in the archives on this Palladian hoax, so we won't spend too much time on that tonight. It's because we have a show on it, and you can it's fascinating. Now, Albert Pike. Well, Albert Pike is best described as a Renaissance man in Victorian times, I think. He was what they would call perhaps a polymath. He was also an autodidacte. He was also self-educated, but he was self-educated in a very, very scholarly way. He now, one of the things I want to point out to you, when you go to Wikipedia, this is a very uneven. Wikipedia's presentation of Pike is very uneven and unbalanced. Usually they do better than this. But just to put it in perspective, he was born December 29th, 1809, in Boston, Massachusetts. And he died April 2nd, 1891, at the age of 81, in Washington, D.C. Now, he was a brigadier general in the Confederate Army, and he was also the sovereign grand commander of the southern jurisdiction of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite of Freemasonry for almost 40 years, I think. He assumed the Eastern seat in 1859, and he held it all the way up to, 1891, I think. This man had a life that was just filled with adventure and accomplishment and extreme scholarship. You can't imagine where, with all the adventurous things he did, he was in the Mexican War, he was a pioneer, he was an active lawyer, and he was a civil rights lawyer for the American Indians, and that was right before the Civil War, where the Indians got on his side. And he was a poet and a marvelous writer, and pretty big fellow, you know, and, you know, well over 6 feet tall, and very imposing. Now, Pike, there are several things about Pike that are very conflicting. For one thing, he's born in Boston, Massachusetts, and he got accepted to Harvard, but he couldn't afford he and his family couldn't afford the tuition. So he later got a scholarship at Harvard and actually refused it. So after a few years of his accomplishments as a lawyer and a writer and everything else, Harvard gave him an honorary master's degree. So he never did get a chance to really go to Harvard. But he certainly acquired an education that even the dons of Harvard respected. Now, Albert Pike, as I said, was a soldier in the Mexican War, and he's a captain of cavalry, and so he had military experience, and he was an attorney out in Arkansas, school teacher, an attorney. And he got into masonry out in Arkansas. He got in the Odd Fellows first, but then he quickly went over to masonry. And he just fell in love with masonry. He thought masonry was wonderful. And he took a very scholarly approach to it. In other words, he wanted to find out where all the rituals came from and how masonry was, what significance of it, and philosophical significance and everything. The Civil War was brewing. Now, one thing about Pike, we have to understand, Pike actually was opposed to slavery. Now, yet, at the same time, Pike, like Abraham Lincoln, Pike thought that the blacks never should have been brought over to America and that they just weren't suitable for our kind of civilization. That's what he believed. Although he wasn't a thoroughgoing racist, because he certainly was a, you know, he didn't hold that view of the American Indians. He was fighting for their rights. He was a civil, what we would call today a civil rights activist, for the American Indians. He even got a $800,000 settlement for them against the federal government, and then the federal government would refuse to pay it. And these, no wonder these Indians fought for him against the Yankees when he raised an Indian regiment during the war between the states. But Pike, you know, he's been accused of being a racist, and I guess we have to just really admit that, yes, he was in this sense. And yet, at the same time, he really was opposed to slavery. He believed it was wrong. And of course, Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln, that, you know, for a long time, the war went on for quite a while before Lincoln did the Emancipation Proclamation. And Lincoln actually wanted to ship as many of the blacks as he could back to Africa. And some people think that's why Lincoln was shot, but I'm not so sure of that. But anyway, so Pike, these claims that Pike was a racist, okay, we'll have to kind of go along with that. But he was a man of his time, and Arkansas was a southern state, and it was his, and he answered the call and put his Indians into this cavalry regiment, and they hated the federal government because of what the federal government had done to them. So they were, you know, they some of his Indians actually owned slaves themselves, but the Battle of Pea Ridge, Pike won the battle against the Yankees, but unfortunately, his braves got a little bit carried away and they scalped some of those Yankees, and that wasn't so good. That was, and Pike didn't approve of that at all, but he got, chastised both by the Confederates and the Yankees for that one. In fact, that and some other accusations that he had to actually escape and hide out for a while. Then he finally managed to get that settled and somehow or other escaped war crimes or whatever at the end of the war. But he had been appointed in Charleston, South Carolina, as the sovereign grand commander of the Scottish Rite. Now, let me explain a little bit about what Scottish Rite masonry is, so you can understand what it was that this very exciting, very dynamic fellow did for Scottish Rite. Scottish Rite masonry is essentially a collection of continental French, mostly French, continental Masonic degrees that are over and above the 3 degrees of Blue Lodge. In other words, tattered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason. Now, just a regular mason, as I'm sure all of you know, a regular mason belongs to a Blue Lodge, and the Blue Lodge does just these 3 degrees. And then finally, when he becomes a master mason, then he is a mason. But then masonry was such a, when it got started back in the very early 1700s over in England, masonry became so popular and so fascinating and all that more degrees were created. And these were called, or technically referred to as Red Lodges. Yeah, that's beginning to sound like the Blue States and the Red States, I know. But anyway, the Red Lodges, and the two primary ones are York Rite, which is a British derivation, has 10 degrees above the first three. And then there's Scottish Rite, which is actually more French than Scottish. It's called Scottish because supposedly masonry got started in Scotland way back in the early 1600s, and then the Scots went over to France and supposedly took some of these degrees. Well, whatever, but so. These French degrees that developed after the British, the first three British degrees in the early 1700s, these French degrees and to some extent German, began to develop around about 1740, 1750, and they spread across Europe. And some of these rites, gosh, the Rite of Memphis goes up to 93 different degrees, but the French degrees that eventually became Scottish Rite included the first 3 degrees of masonry in Scottish Rite, but then they went up to about 28 or something like that total, and then a couple more were added until we had basically 32, and this includes the first three, 32 degrees, and then they added an honorary final degree called the 33rd. Now, they were, as I say, essentially French, and they got imported along with a bunch of other Masonic degrees, over to the New World. And One of the great Masonic scholars, Masonic scholar of the stature of Pike, actually, Albert Mackey. Albert Mackey, who preceded Pike, and the two were contemporaries, Mackey collected most of these continental degrees. And they were, the first, about one-third of them, were, you could call them degrees that continued to extrapolate on the Masonic legend of the temple. They went on and on and on about the ruffians and the elect of the nine and all the various aspects of the original Masonic legend. That was the first section. Then there was another section which were chivalric degrees, somewhat like Rosicrucian and Knights Templar kind of things, that primarily dealt with medieval Europe and whatever. And then finally there were the philosophical degrees, and they got into the Hermetic aspect and the symbolism, still trying to search for the lost word. This is what all of this was supposedly leading to. You know, we lost the word we lost the word in the third degree and Hiram and Solomon. They couldn't, they said, well, Hiram Abiff is dead and now the word's lost. So you could say in a simple sort of way that all the rest of these degrees we're still searching for this lost word. And in a sense, this is true. But these degrees had been created by a whole bunch of different people, and they were all people creating their own particular thing, and they didn't fit together, and they were sort of a hodgepodge. But Mackey had almost all of them. Well, Albert Pike was really the new kid on the block, but boy, he was really really a scholar and really wanted to do the job and wanted to fix the degrees up and make them play and tie them together, and he was willing to do it. So Mackey turned over all of his collection to Albert Pike and said, go to it. And so Albert Pike did, and he just worked and worked, and put out a tremendous amount of work, and he put all of these 32 degrees together into a series of pageants that really do inspire and really do go somewhere philosophically. They actually do have a track. They actually do what they're supposed to do, and they do hang together. And Pike, being a philosopher in his own right, and he was able to infuse into them the philosophy of the ancients and make them really, really work. And so that they are actually very, very good stage players. And that's what ended up happening. Scottish Rite discovered after a while that the best way to do these was to have a regular theater, and many, many, many Scottish Rite temples are designed that way. They have a regular stage, and the one we had in Los Angeles, it's closed down, but we had what amounted to a Broadway theater with $1 million worth of theatrical equipment, lighting and sets and everything, and each one of these degrees becomes a play, and with costumes and sets and props and special effects and all kinds, this got started actually back in the late 1800s. The Scottish Rite started doing this, and it increased, of course, the popularity of it, because this was almost joining Scottish Rite as like being in a little theater group, so this made it very, very attractive. And Scottish Rite still does this. They still have the wardrobe department, makeup department, and everything. It's just that it is really a philosophical, interreligious, philosophical kind of a theatrical group, and it's about the best way to describe it. This is one of the features of it that makes it last. And Pike, his rituals have a lot to do with that, because Pike had a good sense of the drama. He was a poet. He is a man with a good, great sense of drama, sense of. If you read his prose, is just really, really beautiful. And so this was his contribution. Now, let's take a look at his contribution and look at it from a standpoint of what he did do, and then we'll look at the critical aspect of it, of where he was at and what his philosophy was and all this and that. So in dealing with this, so we can see both sides of this, because a reason why this is important is because Scottish Rite right now, today, is divided. I think it's divided three ways. There are the people of the Scottish Rite brothers, the Scottish Rite brothers and officers who really take Scottish Rite seriously. In other words, they're not just doing it because it's fun to do the degrees. I mean, the ones that really take it seriously, and the ones who are dedicated to it, are divided into two camps. And there's the Pikephobes and the Pikephiles. Okay? Now, the Pikephobes would actually, if they could, they'd like to get rid of Pike altogether. If they could somehow do that, they would. And the Pikephiles, and I'm a Pikephile, by the way, the Pikephiles think that Albert Pike is the soul of Scottish Rite, and they will dig their heels in, and they don't want Pike. Not only do they not want Pike's rituals changed, but they don't want Pike dethroned. I mean, they revere Pike, and so I say we because I'm definitely a Pikephile. So, you know, realizing that I'm a Pikephile, you can, I'm going to try to be, I'm trying to be fair to both sides. So let me reluctantly put on a Pikephobe hat here. Seeing we have, you know, in Scottish Rite, we have black hats, we have red hats, and we have white hats. So if we had the Pikephobes, the Pikephobes would have to have a pink hat, maybe, and the Pikephiles would probably have a blue hat or something like that. Well, we actually have blue hats for some other groups or whatever. But anyway, so, okay, the Pikephiles argument is this. This man is a great genius. This man was a marvelous philosopher. This man was a terrific dramatist. This man literally took our mess, all this mess of degrees, and put them all together, made them work, gave us something that's bigger than life, gave us a wonderful tradition, gave us a marvelous edifice, and why just because he happened to be Johnny Raven and all that, so what? Let's venerate him. He was a man of his time, you know, my gosh, you gotta give us Spikophiles some credit, because this man really is a giant. And he really is, you know, I mean, we have a right to have a founder that we revere and, you know, and whatever and all that, and especially when he does beautiful work. Okay, now, what do the Pycophobes have to say here? All right, the Pycophobes, they say, well, for one thing, Pike was a racist. Okay, all right, he was. But at least he was opposed to slavery. Okay, so that's it. So then there, if you're an extreme Pycophobe or an anti-Mason, and you don't know what you're really talking about, you're going to say, yeah, he was also in the KKK. Well, he wasn't, but there is, you know, these, some member of the KKK in about 1905 or something or other said that he was, and no proof of it whatsoever. Pike himself, when asked about that, somebody asked him, you know, well, were you ever involved with the KKK? And Pike said, no, and if I had been, it would have been better organized. And that was Pike's comment. But he, of course, you know, no, he was not a member of the KKK. That was just not the way he did things. If he, you know, if Pike wanted to do something, he did it straight up. He didn't hide behind a sheet. So that aspect of it, no, he wasn't. Now, the other thing, though, the one other incident that is extreme, like, is the one that the Catholics. Well, I said the Catholics. There's Leo Taxil over in France, who was a tabloid, a yellow sheet journalist, who wanted to create this sensational hoax, and he knew how much the Catholic Church hated Masonry and how they and Pike was being so successful with Scottish Rite that they thought he was. Was kind of sinister. So Leo Taxil, this French journalist, this is about the turn of the century, he cooked up this idea. His typist, his secretary, I don't know whether her name was Diana Vaughan or not, but anyway, that's the name he came up with. And Diana Vaughan, this voluptuous, beautiful, mysterious Diana Vaughan, who was the protege of the sinister Albert Pike, the head of the Luciferians. And he was sending Diana Vaughan around to the crowned heads of Europe and the business tycoons on the European continent and initiating them into the sex rites of the Luciferian Palladian Society. Well, this thing ran in the tabloids, in the French tabloids, it ran in a whole big series of articles, and by Diana Vaughan herself, because she was confessing all this, and even the Pope believed it, and Pike, of course, was supposed to be running all of this from a secret satanic chamber in Charleston, South Carolina. It ended up. We did a whole show on this thing, so I really shouldn't spend too much time on it. But it ended up with the Pope wanting to have an audience with Diana Vaughan. She was supposed to be in a convent. And Taxil at this point realized the jig was up, so he made a public confession. But and even though it was a riot, they were pelting him with rotten tomatoes and everything else, there still were a whole bunch of people who believe it. And believe it or not, there are people who believe it to this day. And so if you run into Diana Vaughan, please have her call in, will you? Anyway, that was laid on Pike. Now, why was that laid on Pike? Well, he was the perfect target as far as the extreme, fanatical Catholics, the overstay crowd, that sort of thing. He also mentioned in Morals and Dogma that Lucifer was really not, didn't mean Satan, that this was a mistake, that Lucifer really meant the light bringer, which it does. Oh boy, that was enough right there. For them to say, this man's a Satanist. Oh boy. Well, he wasn't. But, Pike was married, had children, and he was a good Episcopalian. You get that? Yeah, he was a church-going Episcopal member of his Episcopal church. And it was so he really was. He was a Christian. But he really, really researched and dug into all of the background of the ancient mystery religions that all the way from ancient Egypt and Zoroastrianism, especially Zoroastrianism, and the ancient Vedas, and all of the things that the Pythagorean tradition and Hermetic tradition, and all of the things that went into the eventual Christian religion. And all of this, he researched all of this, and researched it exhaustively. And he made a few mistakes, mistakes that were common to his time, by the way, which we'll discuss. But because of this, because degrees and these philosophies presenting, because it goes into all of the background that influenced the Bible and influenced Christianity, influenced Judaism, all of these things by and large, even though Pike has been the Pikeophobes pick Pike, try to find errors in Pike's research and all of that, and they do. They find minor errors, yeah. They find minor stuff, but because Pike was, he was a man of his time. And so they find these errors. But overall, Pike's research was valid. But the fundamental Christians, both in Masonry and outside of Masonry, and the people who are prejudiced and bigoted, they look at they don't want to know what influenced the Bible. They don't want to know that Zoroaster. We wouldn't have an apocalypse, and we wouldn't have a Satan, and we wouldn't have a judgment day. We wouldn't have any of these things. We wouldn't for Zoroaster, and Pike knew that, and Pike knew that Osiris was the precursor of Christ, and that Christ was really the Osirian form. He knew that. He presented all these. He developed the whole scheme of human philosophy and religion that actually influenced the Bible. I mean, but they didn't. The fundamental Christians, they don't want this, and they don't want to know this. They don't want to know that Zoroaster came before. Well, he probably came before Buddha, actually, when you get right down to it. And so they're desperate to try to say, oh, well, Zoroaster isn't any older. You don't think anything else? You know, 500 BC? Well, no, actually, Zoroaster could be a great deal older than that. Pike wasn't right because he took the Greek. The Greeks said Zoroaster was 6,000 years before Christ. Well, obviously, that's probably wrong. But Zoroaster came first. And Pike was a very, very ardent supporter of Zoroaster. He thought Zoroastrianism really was the original, old religion. Now, something that was going on at the time that Pike was studying, and at the time he was doing all this, there was a movement in scholarly, very scholarly movement to uncover archaeologically and everything and all and to study the sacred teachings of the East. When I say that, Persia and India and to really look at these writings and realize that they were older than the Bible, and that they did have an influence on the Bible, and this was the thing at the time, and of course at that time, we had the ethnologists, we call them anthropologists today. They called them ethnologists then. The ethnologists were studying the different races and their traditions. That's a no-no now. This is, you see, political correctness has set in after World War II, so we don't go that route. Although that route's a perfectly logical way to go, but we don't go that route anymore. So the idea that the Aryan race, whatever that is, which includes most of the Europeans, Caucasians, okay, that Zoroaster and the original Vedas, the original Indo-European, the Indo-Iranians that started what became Hinduism in India, these people were the same race as us Europeans, the same essential race, and that their religion was actually earlier than the Bible. It was earlier than Moses, earlier than Abraham, and since then, of course, there have been attempts, to say that then they would actually say, well, maybe that wasn't true, maybe. But then, on the other hand, what preceded Zoroaster, it comes down from Central Asia, Scythians, had an influence both on the Greeks and on the Iranians, and what was generally believed at that time, Nally Hall believed this, by the way, and Pike believed this, that there was an original pure religion that preceded all of the biblical religions and everything, that this original pure religion was, and Pike thought, and along with a lot of other scholars at the time, that this was Aryan. That this pure religion was a religion of light and darkness, good and evil, simple yet marvelously profound, monotheistic, original religion. And Zoroastrianism and the Vedas too were as close as Pike could find to this, and he was not alone in this at all. In fact, this was a very prominent idea. Well, so Pike even tried in his writings. He tried to equate the lost word and masonry with these both Zoroastrian and Vedic formulas. I'm not going to go into that too much because I don't want to be supposedly revealing Masonic secrets, whether they've already been superseded or not. But he did. Pike's primary spiritual focus in developing these degrees. I remember now, he was Christian, and oh boy, a lot of this. As I say, fundamental Christianity owes more to Zoroaster than it does to Jesus, really, when you get right down to it. But they don't want to know that. But Pike was aware of this, and he tries to we being hermetic, it would be nice to say. And I would like to say that Pike was primarily hermetic, aside from being Christian, because of course there are hermetic aspects of Christianity, and there are, and you can be a hermit, you can be a hermetic person and still be a Christian, and it doesn't hurt at all. But it would be nice if we could say that the Hermetic philosophy was Pike's primary focus, but that isn't really true. Actually, his primary focus philosophically was really Zoroaster and Uhura Mazda and this religion, which he thought was pretty close to the earliest religion. And by the way, this was something that Rudolf Steiner, you know, bought into this 100%, and Manuel was very, very enamored of it. Of course, Nietzsche, you know, wrote Prospect Zarathustra, you know, so this Pan-Aryanism was quite respected and considered. Here again, Pike was a man of his time. Now, I want to point out that some references on this to some of you Scottish Rite folks on this Aryan question. Jay Kenney, I'm going to try to get up out of this chair. I've got this easy chair here that traps me, and I have trouble getting up out of it. Jay Kenney wrote I thought I had it with me here. Over. Did I put it over here? No, I didn't. He wrote a two-part article in Plumline, the Scottish Rite Research Society. There we are. There we go. I was just sorry to send this to me. We have Plumline, Fall 2003, Volume 11, Number 3, Albert Pike and the Aryan Question, by J. McNeil Kenney. And, of course, you remember... Jay Kenney was the editor of he and Smalley were the editors of Gnosis, that very fine magazine that lasted for several years and no longer with us. But so then Jay wrote this this article, Pike and the Aryan Question, which he deals with all of this and Pike, where Pike really was in all of this, that's my reference to this. I'd also like to refer you to, by the way, those of you who are in Scottish Rite, the Scottish Rite Research Society is the best, that's the best thing, the best bargain that you can possibly, if you're really, really interested in Scottish Rite. They put wonderful publications, and it's very, very reasonable. And you're just a gold mine of information. One of the books, besides Morals and Dogma, that you really, really want to dig into Pike and his philosophy, it's Albert Pike's Lecture on Masonic Symbolism and the Second Lecture on Symbolism. And this is translated and annotated by illustrious Rex R. Hutchins. And this is a hardback, very nice publication from Scottish Rite Research Society. This has got the meat of Pike's symbolism in it, and what he thinks, the symbolism that Masonry owes to the Bible and everything else, owes to these earlier mystery religions. I cannot recommend this book highly enough, and although I don't necessarily agree with some of Rex's criticisms of Pike, but on the other hand, Rex has done us all a great service by publishing this. This would have been, up until the time it was published, a very, very rare book. So I'll mention that again. A Lecture on Masonic Symbolism and Second Lecture on Symbolism, translated by Rex Hutch. I think that's still available from the Scottish Rite Research Society. One of the things, though, that we want to point out about this Aryan situation, and one of the reasons why I think Jay Kenney's article on this is important, is because During, leading up to, and during and after World War II, this whole Aryan thing got to be a politically incorrect nightmare. In other words, because the Nazis made such a diabolical religion out of this, and not Pike. They didn't consider Pike one of their heroes or anything like that, and Pike really wasn't. He really wasn't approaching this from an idea of racial superiority or anything like that. He was he was approaching it from a philosophical point of view and actually digging into the philosophy. But because of this business of the Aryan master race and all of this, and the fact that the Nazis were trying to use all of this. This archaeology on early Aryan, Zoroastrian material, whatever. Because of that, this whole thing became repugnant, and it became politically incorrect. Now, that's kind of sad because, really. You can't blame Zoroaster for being an Aryan if he was. I mean, he was probably a Scythian, came down from, you know, way up there in Central Asia. And you know, you can't blame him. And he created, Zoroaster, probably the one of the greatest, if not, well, I'm not going to say the greatest, but he was one of the greatest prophets and the greatest expounders of religion who ever lived. And he had tremendous influence here again, we can blame Hitler and Himmler and all that crowd for making this kind of subject almost a verboten. It's a no-no, and that's very sad. And that, but I want you to understand that Albert Pike was really not, he really wasn't promoting that. And that's really, so what his points of view and his extrapolations are true. I mean, kvetching on minor points, but what Pike says and his philosophy said is true. I mean, when you study the teachings of Zoroaster, you put them in perspective, and you realize the influence that they had on our own Bible. You have to realize that this is all valid, and so we can't be just. I don't think we should be. Tarring Pike with a stick. Pike was, I think that we should look at this whole thing and rise above it. There is racism is wrong. Racism is certainly not anything that. But the history of the world is. The way it is, and the history of philosophy is the way it is, and the history of religion is the way it is, and to turn blind eyes to because somebody misused it, it's not a very good thing, and that's one of the reasons why the Pikeophobes want to get rid of Pike, and of course in doing so. In getting rid of Pike and the lessons that he has developed and the teachings that he has expounded, by doing that, we reduce the quality and the authenticity and the power and the worth and actual worth of our degrees. So that's a little bit of sermonizing for me. I think that you know that Pike, that Scottish Rite will suffer and go into decline. That the more they try to remove Pike, I personally think that the less it will survive. But the more they promote Pike, and the more they realize that to stay with him, I think will be much, much better. Anyway, Albert Pike, his whole philosophy is the idea of tolerance and appreciation of all of the religions of the world, and the idea of Scottish Rite as opposed to York Rite is to have a Masonic body that any person of any religion can go through the Scottish Rite degrees and not be particularly offended, providing you're not, you know, a fundamentalist, and that we can have a universal appreciation of God, and this is what Pike firmly believed. Now, these continental degrees, this is something that we should also notice and take notice of. These continental degrees were more radical politically. They were more radical, and they were more anti-clerical. They were than the British degrees. See, in British masonry was respectable and really wanted to do above board business, what have you. So they had to get the approval of the king and the church. Okay, so they even had to modify the rituals a little bit to make sure that the king and the church were okay with it. And from then on out, British masonry was a government approved. In a fashionable place for businessmen to meet and socialize and do their ritual and get together, and the purpose of it, of course, was they had several sects and different religious sects that were all arguing with each other, and this allowed them to all get together, but they did it under the approval of the king and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Okay, so, and in Britain, didn't the Prince of Wales is always the Grand Master, and then they have a Deputy Grand Master, of course, every year that actually runs things. But British Masonry, as the point that I made back when we did our Masonic Conspiracy Show, which we reran just recently, and that was one of our most popular shows. British Masonry and American Masonry follows the philosophy of John Locke, which is liberal, but private property and individual rights are maintained. But it's still liberal. It's politically liberal, but private property and individual rights. Okay. Continental Masonry, on the other hand, and now we're talking about the Illuminati and all that bunch. Continental Masonry, they didn't even insist that you believe in God. They could take atheists. They were anti-religious, anti-establishment, anti-royal, anti-everything, and except what they call progress. And they followed the philosophy of Rousseau. Those degrees, they did. And a number of them did. So Continental Masonry can get pretty radical. And by the way, George Washington wouldn't allow the Illuminati in the United States. He he was dead set against them. And although Thomas Jefferson kind of liked them, but Washington would not allow it. But the Illuminati did have some influence on the French Revolution and one thing or another. And they followed the philosophy of Rousseau and Helvetius. And so that was the origin of not just socialism, but that was actually the Illuminati. It was the origin of Bolshevism. They didn't believe in private property. They didn't want to take, you know, they were and the individual rights or anything like that. The Illuminati were for complete communism, what eventually became Bolshevism. And the Illuminati. So some of these degrees that Pike ended up working with were pretty radical, and Pike actually got those degrees. When he reworked these degrees, these continental degrees, he reworked them and he made them. He really made sure that they corresponded to the philosophy of John Locke and not this Rousseau and Helvetius and all the rest of this radical crowd. And he did that. And so some of the people that are criticizing Pike, think that this guy really did a good job, and I think we should consider that. Now next week we are we're doing the Cypher manuscript. That's a rerun of the Cypher manuscript of the Golden Dawn. And on the 20th of December, we will have Bill Mesteel and his book on the four elementals. And so we'll have Bill back on. And meanwhile, good magic.